Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR on CFRU. This is Siegfried. And I just want to say thanks for being patient with me, everyone. Seeing I just got started up again with the show last week after a long absence. And talking about the reactionary politics surrounding COVID-19 and this explosion of anti-Asian racism that's emerged since January, it was not an easy thing for me. This new Cold War situation has been difficult. As many of you know, I've lived in China and know many people there. And to see this kind of wholesale demonization of a country and its people, not only in corporate media, but also in certain alternative media outlets too, is not an easy thing to deal with. It's not an easy thing for me to deal with. I find it offensive. I find it infuriating. I find it sad. And I can only imagine how Asian Canadians and Asian Americans feel about it, seeing this propaganda blaming Chinese people and anyone who looks Chinese for the pandemic and a ton of other things besides, you know, puts them in actual physical danger. Like I talked about last week, 1/3 of Chinese Canadians report being physically assaulted. They've reported being physically assaulted since the pandemic began. 1/3 of Chinese Canadians. And as Fred Hampton once said, you can only fight racism with solidarity. And it's really disheartening just how little of that I see and have seen with regard to Asian Americans and Asian Canadians right now. But there are a lot of struggles going on in the world. There are a lot of people standing up against oppression and racist violence. We saw the explosion of defiance that emerged in the wake of George Floyd's killing in Minneapolis this past June. The spread of BLM, Black Lives Matter protests across North America and beyond, including what has to be the largest ever protest march that Guelph has seen in living memory. You know, we're talking over 5,000 people coming out in support of Black life this past June, you know, on the streets of downtown. I was there, and it took my breath away. I never thought I'd see that kind of mobilization in this town around anything. And yet, in the midst of a pandemic, it just, you know, just exploded. And just the streets were just full. And that's inspiring. And we've seen the amazing level of resistance from Portland to New York City, with tons of people coming out in defiance of racist police brutality, you know, even in the face of massive state violence and the threat of hard jail time in some cases. The systemic racism of the capitalist system, you know, was really in the spotlight this summer, and certain communist organizations in the U.S., most notably the Party for Socialism and Liberation, PSL, played a remarkable role in these demonstrations, with their members putting their bodies on the line in cities like Denver and risking major prison sentences in order to stand with the people. You know, we're in a very interesting time. I mean, more and more people are coming to understand this year that the system doesn't care about them. You know, it's willing to shoot Black and brown people to death in the streets and in their own homes, in the case of Breonna Taylor. It's willing to throw people under the bus during a pandemic. It's willing to make massive giveaways to Wall Street and Bay Street while working class people are stretched to the breaking point. It's willing to build concentration camps for kids, railroad millions of mostly racialized people into prisons. I mean, you name it. All the while claiming to stand for freedom and liberty. You know, pumping out just a steady stream of BS that increasingly people are seeing through based on their own experience. Because it just seems everything is coming to a head this year. You know, just crisis after crisis. You know, you can't ignore it. And anyone who can look at the Trump-Biden debates and still think that the USA is a healthy place to live is, number one, either safe and secure in their mansion on the hills, or number two, just deluded beyond reason. You know, that's pretty much what it's come down to. But getting back to the situation in Canada and the matter of Indigenous resistance to settler colonialism, something which I've covered pretty extensively on this show and covered pretty extensively at the beginning of this year around Wet'suwet'en, I think many of you who listen to the show will be familiar with what's been going on in Nova Scotia and how much the situation has escalated in recent weeks. I mean, here we have Mi'kmaq fishermen suffering a brutal campaign of racist violence on their own land. They've been physically assaulted. Their boats have been sabotaged. Their catch has been spoiled. And their buildings have been set on fire. The perpetrators of this violence are white settler commercial fishermen, and the RCMP has done nothing to stop them, and has in fact violently arrested Mi'kmaq fishermen instead. Meanwhile, corporate fishing companies are just licking their lips at the prospect of taking over what's left of Mi'kmaq sovereign territory on the East Coast. You know, most notably, Clearwater Lobster, a major offshore fishing company headed by CEO John Risley. They've been fishing on unceded, stolen Mi'kmaq lands and waters for decades now, and they've enjoyed special treatment from the federal and provincial governments. Unlike small-scale lobster fishers, the Clearwater is able to fish year-round with its large fleet. It has a near monopoly on lobster fishing licenses and is able to essentially disregard government regulations at will at this point. They have those kind of connections. And the monopolization of East Coast fisheries under a neoliberal economic regime since the 1980s and the subsequent destruction of independent producers has led to the current situation where settler fishermen are attacking indigenous fishermen over control of a shrinking slice of the pie, basically. You know, basically fighting over like what the big commercial fishers, you know, the big corporations haven't taken yet. And this is a classic example of how white supremacy buttresses capitalism. Instead of attacking Clearwater and these big fishing companies that have been driving them to economic ruin, these white fishermen are attacking those they deem to be racially inferior. They don't blame capitalism for their problems. They blame the Indians next door, who they accuse of being freeloaders and sponging off the state because they have legal rights to their ancestral territory. And this prejudice is common across Canada. And all it results in is, you know, more destroyed communities and more destroyed lives. You know, like the fishing communities around St. Mary's Bay in Nova Scotia that will go belly up if companies like Clearwater have their way and they're able to drive out the last independent operators, drive them out of the lobster business. And what happens then? I mean, do these out-of-work fishermen then go to the man camps raised on stolen indigenous land in northern BC and Alberta to work on the oil patch and the pipelines that are still being driven across unceded Wet'suwet'en territory without consent? Do they choose to be shock troops for a racist system that will use them and then discard them all over again? How many times does this have to happen? How many times does this have to happen before they realize that they're nothing more than pawns? When are they going to realize the system doesn't care about them? When are they going to understand that they're going to have to fight the real enemy? Maybe then they might stand alongside oppressed people and show some solidarity. But speaking of solidarity, and this, I gotta say, has really brought my spirits up this past week, I really needed this piece of good news. The people of Bolivia have just elected a new socialist government by a landslide as of October 18th. The results are official now, and it's truly inspiring in light of what that country, which is, you know, two-thirds indigenous, you know, two-thirds of Bolivians are indigenous. This election is truly inspiring in light of what that country has been through over the past year. Some of you might remember the show I did last November when I expressed my solidarity with the Bolivian people as they faced up to a U.S.-backed military coup that toppled President Evo Morales, South America's first indigenous president, after bogus charges of electoral fraud were leveled against him by his right-wing political opponents. And the result was an orgy of fascist violence by right-wing paramilitary groups, the police and the military, including numerous massacres of indigenous people, and the rise to power of a illegitimate oligarchical regime kept in power by force with the full blessing of Washington, which was eager to privatize Bolivia's natural gas and lithium reserves. I mean, you might remember Elon Musk getting all giddy about the coup last November on Twitter and saying stuff like, you know, he'll coup whoever he wants or something to that effect. And of course, the reason he was giddy, he was, you know, really interested in securing cheap lithium batteries for Tesla. And it's like, oh yeah, you know, lithium, you know, this coup happened in Bolivia. And now, like, you know, there's lithium's going to get privatized and we can take it over and we can just like reap the rewards, you know. This is what he was so excited about, you know, securing cheap lithium batteries for Tesla, conveniently harvested on stolen indigenous land in the global south, right? You know, same old story. And while Evo Morales, you know, he had every intention of developing Bolivia's lithium, but he was going to do it via the public sector with assistance from China, thus ensuring that the profits stayed within the country and could be used to raise living standards for ordinary people. And this, of course, was unacceptable to the United States, the Fortune 500, and their local proxies. Evo Morales, a legitimate elected president, was forced into exile after the coup and is now in Argentina. But things have changed a lot since last year. And Elon Musk is not a happy camper right now. I mean, you've probably seen the memes on social media. There's a lot circulating right now. I mean, despite facing major political persecution, attacks on its members, the jailing and exile of its leaders, and the silencing of its media outlets, the movement towards socialism, MAS, Evo Morales, his political party, kept fighting all throughout the pandemic, mobilizing millions of working class and racialized people in Bolivia who had been kicked to the curb by the coup government. You know, mobilizing all these people, and they won a crushing victory against all odds in the election. With Luis Arce, who was Evo Morales' economy minister, winning over 55% of the vote to become the new president of Bolivia. And this is after, like, you know, it's worth noting that the coup government didn't even want to have the election on the 18th. I mean, they knew which way the wind was blowing. Despite all their draconian efforts, you know, to suppress the MAS, to suppress the socialist movement in Bolivia, to suppress indigenous people, in poll after poll, no matter what they did, MAS, the Socialist Party, was coming out on top in all the polls throughout the year. And they're, you know, they were their favorite to win any election. This is why the coup government kept delaying the election. It was originally supposed to happen in the spring, but they delayed it again and again. And they didn't even want to have it on the 18th of October. The only reason they had it on the 18th was because they were forced to give in and agree to the election after a massive general strike shut down the country in September and basically forced the government to agree to elections. And remember, this is after the coup government privatized everything, dismantled large sections of the economy, put thousands of people out of work, and then provided no support to anyone when the country was locked down during the pandemic. And that drove a lot of people to the edge of starvation. And this was in addition to the racist violence against the indigenous majority and a huge surge in femicide and violence against women over the course of this year. People had just, they had enough. People had enough. They rose up and they took the power back. And the results are undeniable. It's also telling that over 50% of the newly elected lawmakers are women in Bolivia, in the Bolivian legislature. MAS, the movement towards socialism, the party that was overthrown in last year's coup, now has a greater electoral majority than ever. And it looks like Evo Morales can finally come home. And the important takeaway from this is that the Bolivian elite, the Bolivian capitalists, and their backers in Washington could not keep the Bolivian people down. no matter how much force they used. And I hope the same can be said for Chile, where people have been going out in the streets, massive protests over the past year against a brutal neoliberal austerity regime there. I mean, in Chile, they're about to vote in a referendum on a new constitution with an opportunity to reject the undemocratic constitution imposed by the Pinochet dictatorship in the 1980s. And finally bring in a democratic constitution that actually serves the needs of the people. And I hope the same can be said for Venezuela, where parliamentary elections will be held in December. And in Ecuador, where elections will be held early next year, where they've also been fighting against a very brutal neoliberal regime. And ultimately, I hope the left is coming back. Because the political situation in South America has been pretty grim for years now, with right-wing, pro-American governments doing real damage to people and to the environment. I mean, you just see like what happens in, you know, catastrophic damage in some cases. I mean, you look at what happens in Brazil over the past few years, where the Amazon has been on fire, where hundreds of thousands of people are now dead because of the neglect that right-wing government has had during the pandemic, has, you know, just shown complete callous disregard for the people and not put meaningful like safeguards in place at all. But now there's reason to believe that the tide is turning once again and that things are going to get better. Segundina Flores, the leader of the Bartolina Sisa, National Confederation of Campesino, Indigenous, and Native Women of Bolivia, had this to say when she spoke to Telesur on October 24th, you know, in the wake of the Bolivian election and the victory of the MAS. She said, and of course the MAS like, is really built on social movements, indigenous social movements, women's social movements, working class social movements in Bolivia. So Segundina Flores said, "Today, a democracy will return, which is egalitarian, a participatory democracy, a democracy for all." And you know, I wish we can get to the point where something similar could be said right here in Canada. Because a lot needs to happen here. A lot needs to change. I mean, we're seeing corporate developers, you know, still trying to steal Caledonia from Six Nations right here in Ontario. You know, where a judge has just filed an injunction against Indigenous land defenders who have been facing major police repression. You know, the protest movement in support of Wet'suwet'en earlier this year was one of the most powerful political movements that I've ever been a part of. And it's painful to see that it wasn't enough to secure justice for Indigenous people living on unceded land in BC. They're still fighting against the pipelines. They're still standing up against the cops. You know, they have no choice, even though they dropped out of the headlines months ago. They're still fighting back. They have to. Just like the Mi'kmaq fishermen are still fighting back on the East Coast, and just like the people at Six Nations are fighting back. And we can still choose to stand with them. And if we have any real integrity and really are sincere in our desire for justice and for a just future, we're going to have to. Solidarity, brothers and sisters. All power to the people. And Back in the USSR is going to be back after this short break. Please stay tuned.
Vamos a cantar todos juntos, gracias.
Vamos.
Ahora vamos a cantar todos. Todos juntos, por favor. Gracias, muchas gracias.
El
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Mercedes Sosa, Solo Le Pido Adios, right? A very, I ask only of God, is what that song translates to in English. Famous protest song in South America. And I thought it was pretty appropriate, I guess, for the subject matter of the show. Of course, we talk a lot about like the struggle of the people of Bolivia to secure justice after like a full year of living under a coup regime, brutal coup regime. And so I really want to round out the show, seeing we talk so much about that. I want to play a clip from the Gray Zone Project. Gray Zone Project was actually a progressive media outlet, independent media outlet, was actually on the ground in Bolivia during the elections. And suffered some considerable threats, like open threats from like right-wing forces in that country for their coverage of the election. But they sat down with a progressive Bolivian journalist, Oli Vargas, on October 23rd. And the discussion they had surrounding the election and the aftermath and also what led up to that electoral victory is very, very interesting and very thorough. And they... And Ollie can definitely explain it a lot better than I can about the overall situation in the country. So I want to close the show with that. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR, and please listen to this whole interview with Ollie Vargas, because it's absolutely amazing.
Hi, everyone. I'm Anya Parampil, and this is Red Lines. My guest today is Ollie Vargas. He's a journalist with Causachun News in Bolivia. We're here in La Paz, the political capital of the country, not the official capital. That's a story for another day. But Ollie, I'm so glad to finally meet you and to be able to spend this time with you in Bolivia.
No, likewise. It's been great having you guys here and sharing, you know, the wonders that Bolivia holds.
Which are many, and it was emotional for all of us to witness the victory of MAS, the Movimiento Socialismo, on Sunday. Many have framed this overwhelming victory as the Bolivian people voting out fascism at the polls. Is the story that simple?
Of course not. Bolivians had to fight, actually, in the streets just for the right to vote a few days ago. The elections were supposed to be held on May the 3rd. They got delayed. They're supposed to be held in June, delayed again. In September the 6th, delayed again. And so people realised that what was going on was that the government didn't want to hold elections. They knew they were behind in the polls. Anya specifically was a distant third at that time. And they wanted to rule indefinitely through force alone. This is, of course, a government that was never elected. So people, anger grew. And then in early August, when they announced another suspension of the elections, people came out in an extremely organized way in a general strike. There was a huge workers' march in El Alto, which is the city connected to where we are now, where it was decided at this mass meeting that all out, you know? And what a general strike means in Bolivia is not just that people will stop working or stay at home. It means that people block all the key strategic highways of the country. And this took place in every single department, every single region, campesino groups, the indigenous groups, the sort of Workers' Union Federation, which is the COB, the Central Obrera Boliviana. And it was a total shutdown of the country. There was instances of actually people, some in some areas of the country, near La Paz, Achacachi, they were armed in a few points, and the government was talking about terrorism and that they would have to intervene, sort of militarily attack, sort of militarily take back the country, you know, which would have been an incredibly difficult task because this was a movement that spanned, as I said, every single region of the country. And it was only after that the MAS managed to win guarantees for elections. And it's the only reason people were able to go out and vote. During that movement, in fact, there were even more radical sections outside the MAS who were calling for the immediate overthrow of the government, but the MAS, especially Evo Morales, was very clear that, you know, we want to take power peacefully. We'll use the social struggle to get there. But, you know, we're from the culture of peace and we want to get to power like we did in 2005 through elections. So that's how the MAS, you know, the Movement Towards Socialism was founded with the idea that you, the social struggle and the electoral struggle have to go together. They can't go apart. Because throughout Latin American history, you've had social struggle without electoral participation, guerrilla groups, this sort of thing. And that has led to victory in very few places. And a lot of places like Colombia is led to protracted civil wars, repression, etc. But likewise, if you just take an electoral approach without that social base, without that social struggle, well, you go the way of a million left-wing parties that you have in every country around the world. Maybe you do well, one or two elections disappear a couple of years later. And that's the history of the Bolivian left as well. There's numerous left-wing parties that have done very well electorally, didn't win, but then disappear a few years later. But the mass is something much deeper than that because they combine electoral participation with permanent social struggle on the ground, in the indigenous communities, in workplaces. And that's something that's been going throughout this whole year. And without that struggle, this moment would have never come. Because without that struggle, the mass would have disappeared once you start persecuting a few of its leaders. Evo Morales is gone. Luis Arce had numerous charges invented against him. The leading Senate candidates were being persecuted. If the mass was just an electoralist party, it would have disappeared with that. Gone into hiding, gone the way of many parties in Latin America that have gone extinct.
And last year's coup, which brought the Áñez government into power, was legitimized largely by a report put forward by the Organization of American States, which accused Mas of voter fraud. That report has been debunked by several institutions, including MIT. But how did Sunday's results specifically damage that report's credibility even more?
So many ways. I mean, Evo Morales won last year with just over 10%, 10.3, 10.4, something like that. And that was called electoral fraud. And now Luis Arce has won with well over 20%, up to 30% it could reach by the end of today. And we have the official results maybe tomorrow. But something else that's quite interesting, I think that was highlighted by the Center for Economic and Policy Research, also by the CELAC think tank, was that the OAS in their report listed a number of places in rural areas where they believe fraud took place, where there were irregularities. And actually, they compared the figures from then and now. And actually, in all of those precincts, in all of those sort of voting centres, the mass got a higher vote than they did in 2019. So what they're saying is that the mass committed electoral fraud to inflate their vote then. But now, in an election held by a hostile government, they got an even higher score. Some places where the mass got 84%, now they're getting 95%. So how can the whole discourse around fraud is beginning to dissolve, is beginning to sort of wither away in the sort of public consciousness. People are starting to realize, how could there have been fraud if they've come back even stronger now?
Absolutely. How do you think average Bolivians responded to seeing figures such as Luis Almagro, the Secretary General of the Organization of American States, congratulating them on this vote?
Well, I mean, Evo Morales' daughter responded to him saying, keep your congratulations to yourselves, for your own dignity and for our dignity. But at the end of the day, I think Bolivians are relieved. They're relieved that they've managed to win without so far. They managed to win to a point where even the top sections of the military are now having to distance themselves from the government, where the US State Department is having to congratulate them. That's how overwhelming the victory is. When you get to that point where your enemies feel like they can't attack you anymore, that's like hegemony, right? That's like you've achieved a momentum that's unstoppable. So I think people are very relieved. And people thought that this would be a much longer struggle. People were very prepared to go back to what was going on in August, total general strike, indefinite, a situation where people would have to give their lives like they did at the start of the year. So to have won so overwhelmingly is a huge relief. Obviously we've got to see. The mass isn't, Luis Arce is not president yet. The mass hasn't taken power yet. He's not going to take power till December. A lot can happen in that time. So maybe people are a bit too relaxed, but, people are very aware of what the government could do between now and then.
As someone who spent the last year in Bolivia since the coup and the takeover, What do you believe some of the main expectations will be from the MAS of the new government?
There's huge expectations, and they're going to be difficult to meet. Because there's a huge, the number one issue, obviously, the number one priority for the MAS is the economic crisis, rebuilding the economy. You know, for 14 years, Bolivia went from being the poorest country in the region into its fastest growing economy through the economic model built by Luis Arce when he was economy minister, which includes the nationalization of natural resources, and not just natural resources, but strategic industries, and then using those profits to invest in infrastructure, state development, social welfare programs, things like this. And all of that sort of economic base infrastructure that's been built up has been largely destroyed in just a year, in fact. And this is before COVID-19 hit, that all the key state development projects like the industrialization of lithium, industrialization of natural gas, the plant in Bula Bula, Urian, producing ammonium, fertilizer, and things, all those development projects that was led by state-owned companies have been paralyzed. If you go to Uyuni, which is where they were processing the lithium, producing batteries, producing cars, those factories are now closed. The factory I mentioned producing ammonia using natural gas in Bula Bula in the Tropical of Cochabamba, that's been closed since the coup. That had thousands of workers, skilled, you know, industrial workers working there now out of a job. And there's a number of other key infrastructure projects, trains in Cochabamba. But it just shows that the coup government didn't believe in state-led development. They withdrew from the economy, and then you had an economic recession before the pandemic hit. Then the COVID-19 hit, and then they saw the political opportunities of keeping everyone locked at home, and they jumped at it, and they imposed a sort of total lockdown, rigid lockdown, when there was only one or two cases in the country. But they didn't provide any economic support for the majority of the country that works in the informal economy. You know, if you work in the informal economy, you aren't going to have an employer that's paying you or that can offer some sort of payment during this time. If you're someone who works in the market and then suddenly no one's allowed to come to the market, you go hungry. And the government didn't provide any support for those people. So then what happens? Consumer demand disappears. What happens after that? Small businesses, economic activity disappears. And now you get to where we are now, where unemployment has more than tripled. By July, unemployment had tripled. So by now, it would be an even higher amount. So there's an extraordinary economic crisis going on. Should mention as well that the key state industries in gas and lithium as well have been stripped bare. So it's going to be a huge task rebuilding that. And that's the main reason that the MAS won. It's the main reason. There's obviously a cultural, identitarian allegiance to the MAS. But the main reason was that people had the experience. However much the media in this country would, you know, attack the MAS or portray the economic growth of the past few years as illusory, the fact is that people lived it in their actual lives. So however much you lie, however much propaganda there is, you can't break people's actual experiences. And compare, people also have experience to when Carlos Mesa was in government. Carlos Mesa was the main right-wing candidate, pro-coup candidate in this election, and he was the president 2003 to 2005. So a majority of voters in this country experienced what he was like in government. They experienced the moments when he had to take out loans from the IMF to pay teachers' salaries. That's an awful situation to be in. You know, if you're a private individual, you have to take out loans from the bank just to pay your bills or pay your rent. That's a very bad situation. It's one thing to take out loans to maybe set up your own business or something, because that's an investment. And that's what has happened in the government of Evo Morales. They accused him of being in the pocket of China or Russia for taking out loans of China. But those loans were for infrastructure investment, for investment in these sort of key state development projects, factories, industries, something that brings a return to Bolivians. Whereas what Carlos Mesa was doing was taking out loans just to pay the basic costs of the state. That's an incredibly economically disastrous position to be in. So people have lived through that. So however much spin, however much media, you know, propaganda there is, people have lived it in their daily lives.
And I imagine some sort of truth and reconciliation for the crimes committed by this coup government will be a major part, or at least a desire, an expectation of the people after MAS takes power.
Yeah, that's another key priority, is justice for the massacres, the persecution that took place. The words that have always stuck with me is the words of Leonardo Losa. He's a union leader. He's now a senator for Cochabamba. And at a rally that I was at, he said, we're of the culture of peace. We're not here to take revenge. We're not here to, you know, settle scores. But we're not gonna forget nor forgive those who made us cry. And he's from the Tropico of Cochabamba, the Chapare region, the most organized section of the MAS. And it was those people that were killed in Sacaba. 10 people were killed that day on 15th of November last year while protesting for democracy, for the return of Evo Morales. And those wounds are still there. In most of the federations of that region, they have people who have been killed, even more who are still injured, who are still in hospital now, unable to pay their bills. The union members, like their comrades in the unions, try and help them fund their hospital stays. But it's an incredibly difficult situation. So people, that's the number two demand of the social movements. It's justice for the massacres, specifically lock away Arturo Murillo, the interior minister, and the minister of defense, Fernando Lopez, the president, Añez, and the generals who are coordinating with the paramilitary groups. Because in the massacres of Sacaba, the far-right paramilitary group Resistencia Juvenil Coachella were there, armed by the police, working with the police to carry out the massacre. So there needs to be justice for the massacres and for the paramilitary activity that took place with the backing of the state.
Well, we hear a lot about the MAS, the Movimiento al Socialismo element of the party. The second aspect of its name, IPSP, or a political instrument for the sovereignty of the people, isn't emphasized as much outside of Bolivia. So what would you tell people the significance of that aspect of the party is?
It's key. And in fact, in a lot of rallies that I've been at, they only refer to it as the political instrument. They don't talk about the mass. They talk about long live the political instrument. And that's because the movement towards socialism, MAS IPSP, is not a political party, a traditional political party, a sort of left-wing political party. It's not an organization you can sort of go online and you fill out your bank details and join as an individual. In fact, it's impossible to join as an individual. You can only join through being affiliated to a social movement. And the MAS, the leadership of the MAS, is just a committee of the social movement leaders, which is the main social movement of the country. That is the National Campesino Rural Workers Confederation, the National Women Indigenous Women's Confederation, and two or three other indigenous groups on a national level. It's a coalition, of social forces. And to participate in a party, you have to be part of those movements. And that's what I mentioned earlier, the organic strength of the MAS, why the MAS hasn't been able to disappear despite persecution, despite being massacred, being arrested, being, you know, targeted. It's because it doesn't consist of one or two leaders with good ideas or good politics. It consists of a MAS of people organised in their daily lives. But the most important thing, I think, to understand the MAS is its history. It grew out, firstly, of the struggle against the US military presence in the Chapare region. That was where Evo Morales was the union leader. And in that region, they decided that, you know, it's not enough for us as indigenous people to just talk about, oh, you know, there's issues of our lands, we're being discriminated against, oh, this river in our community is being contaminated, we have to stop this. No, we have to move out of that defensive struggle and into offensive struggle to take power. You know, we can't just ask for our rights, we have to actually take power. That's the only way we can ensure respect for ourselves, is by governing ourselves. And from the Chapare region, they went out to the rest of the country and built to the other social movements in the rest of the country. They affiliated, more and more movements affiliated, but precisely with that argument, we're not a party, we're not a political party, we're a political instrument for these movements, is a weapon with which we participate in politics and eventually take power. And that's why the MAS is a force that can't be beaten in Bolivia. Because the right-wing parties, what are they? What do they represent? Every year, every 2 years, they change names, they change alliances. That's because there's alliances of two, three people. Juntos, which is the party of Añez, already doesn't exist. It was created in February or March, and already it doesn't exist. They'll create a new party. because it's just two or three individuals making some corrupt deals. And of course, with time, you know, they get swept away. But the MAS is the only party that has stood in every election since 2002. It's the only party that stood in every election since then, because it represents real social forces that started with union struggle, social struggle, and then moved into the political struggle to take power. That's the key.
How do you believe Luis Arce will differ from his predecessor, Evo Morales, in terms of governing style and policy, if you think there will be major differences?
Well, that's something that I think Bolivian media and a lot of international media are trying to play up, that there's going to be big differences. They're hoping that Arce will be someone who moves to the right. They're taking comments by Arce, which Evo made himself, that Evo, of course, won't be in the next government. Saying, oh, look, he's going to move away from what Evo was doing. But no, that's not true. Luis Arce was the key number two, number three person in Evo Morales' government for the whole of the past 14 years. In terms of governing style, very different, of course. Evo Morales is a union leader. He came up from the rank and file, whereas Luis Arce is part of the middle class. He was educated in the UK. He's in this sort of expert economist. But he's a socialist. Before joining the government, before becoming economy minister, he had a very important sort of study circle here in La Paz called the Los Duendes, which was sort of a Marxist economic study circle where they would draw up plans about how you can build an economy post-neoliberalism. That's why he was chosen by Evo Morales, chosen by the vice president at the time, García Linera, to join the government. He was moving in the same sort of Marxist intellectual circles. Before that, he was a member of the Socialist Party One, which is a sort of historic party that doesn't really exist anymore, but was very important in the 80s and 70s. So he comes from a different class background, different political tradition to Evo Morales, but they've developed the same political tradition, which is the process of change and the economic model that they both govern with.
Right-wing candidate of the Creemos party, Luis Camacho, was facing a lot of pressure to drop out of the race in order to consolidate opposition to MAS, the support for the opposition to MAS, under the neoliberal centrist candidate, Carlos Mesa. We now see that it looks as though MAS would have won even if all of Camacho's support had been thrown behind Mesa. But why is the rise of Camacho important within the Bolivian political context?
It's very interesting. When the coup took place, I remember being very surprised at the popularity that Camacho had. Camacho was the kind of leader of the street movements, the sort of middle-class, violent protest movements that destabilized the country and created the conditions in which the coup could happen. He hoped that after the coup that he'd have his position in power, and he was given certain, his allies were given certain ministries. But then he's a loose cannon. He's a thug, he's a violent person, and they saw him as a dangerous element. They pushed him out of the government, and now he took this like very confrontational stance as like, oh, we're the real sort of revolution, we're the real sort of right-wing forces in the country, these people are a bunch of sellouts. And what's happened now is very interesting. He's massively damaged the right, because there's always been the cultural regional divide in Bolivia, especially within the oligarchy, between the sort of enlightened liberal oligarchy here in La Paz and the kind of more brutish, racist, violent landowning elites in Santa Cruz, in the east of the country. And Camacho represents that tradition, and Carlos Mesa, as a sort of more well-mannered liberal figure, represents the former tradition. I guess it's similar to the United States, where you have, as I understand it, sort of coastal elites that, you know, maybe look at the oligarchy in different parts of the country and see them as sort of brutish and thuggish and things like this. So the rise of Camacho has destroyed the kind of right-wing unity that existed at the time of the coup. And the fact the election results showed that he won Santa Cruz of a landslide, and Carlos Mesa got 17% in Santa Cruz. So that has destroyed the possibility of a united right-wing opposition. Now they're just divided culturally, regionally, into two blocks. And that will massively benefit the MAS.
While the people have won a massive popular victory here in Bolivia, the same military and the same police responsible for last year's coup and the subsequent violence are still in place. How can Arce and the MAS begin to confront that issue?
It's going to be the most difficult question, obviously. At this moment, at the time of filming this interview, obviously, Luis Arce is not going to be wanting to say anything. The military and the police are in charge of this transition. Luis Arce is not in power till December, so they're going to be very careful to not trigger another coup, a second coup. That's been a threat throughout this whole year, the possibility of a kind of Fujimori-style self-coup. I think we're seeing something quite interesting going on in the military and the police. I think I mentioned earlier that the chief of the military, Sergio Orellana, who's someone who was promoted by Añez because he was a right-wing loyalist, he released a letter attacking Arturo Murillo. Apparently he made some sort of derogatory comment. But that's not the issue. The issue is looking for something with which to attack the government, distance himself, and to try and curry favour with the MAS. I don't think the MAS are very aware about what his role is, and they'll be wanting to reorganise that. There are sections of the military that are very pro-MAS, factions that are very, very... I myself witnessed when we were travelling with a Senate candidate, Andronico Rodriguez, military checkpoints around the Tropico of Cochabamba. We get stopped and, you know, the routine is that they search a car and then the soldier would come up and be like, "Oh, you're Andronico." We'd be like, you know, we'd be nervous. "We're going to win." He's held his hands out. You know, that was the kind of attitude there was amongst large sections of the rank and file of the military. So I think there's a base in which they can build a new military. And I think people would be demanding that. The police is a much more difficult issue because the police is massively corrupt. That's true before Evo Morales, during Evo Morales, and even more so now. Police is massively corrupt, essentially apolitical, and will move to the side that sort of funds them. As in the coup last year, it was revealed that Camacho's father, who's a millionaire, was the one that was offering bribes to the police to turn against Evo Morales. That will have to be restructured. Maybe that will happen naturally. Just today it was announced that the chief of police, Ivan Rojas, who's the person that appeared on TV every time a MAS figure was arrested, he'd appear on TV sort of boasting about it, like, "Oh, we're cracking down." He just decided to take his annual holiday. He requested his annual holiday. It's been granted. You know, who knows where he'll go? Maybe somewhere with a beach.
I wanted to talk about one of the players in the media, which has influenced a lot post-coup in Bolivia, because in the lead up to the election, when some observers, electoral observers invited by the government from Spain arrived in the country, they were actually effectively doxxed online. Not only were their names and their personal information released, but the photos actually taken of them when they were at the border by Bolivian migration were published online, and it was specifically in this outlet, OK Diario. I'm wondering who exactly is behind that outlet, because that suggests there's very close coordination between it and the coup government.
Yes, so OK Diario is a magazine in Spain run by leading figures of a party called Vox, which is a sort of neo-Francoist, neo-fascist organization, which sort of burst onto the political scene a few years ago in Spain. There's been a long-standing relationship between Vox, sort of neo-fascist forces in Spain, and Latin America, not just Bolivia. They've had people go to Venezuela, meeting with Juan Guaido, Nicaragua, and Bolivia has been a key base for them. They've been paid guests of Murillo. And the most important sort of piece that they've had here is a journalist called Alejandro Entrambasaguas, who's this kind of crazy sort of young far-right journalist who shot to fame actually a couple of years ago when he was actually investigated for sort of harassing Pablo Iglesias' wife while she was pregnant. And he had a number of lawsuits around that. Then he came to Bolivia. Just after the coup, he came to Bolivia and was a kind of mouthpiece for the government. And what was really odd, it was not just that he was a sort of propaganda sort of person, activist, but that actually the state was feeding him exclusives, sort of raw information that they themselves didn't want to publish, and that Bolivia's mainstream media didn't want to publish, that they'd feed it to him, or fabricated evidence that they'd, you know, concocted in the police stations and things like this. They feed it to him, publish it through him, because of course, you know, once the mass won again, a foreign outlet can't be tried for things like defamation or fake news. So there was a very clear relationship between Arturo Murillo, the Interior Ministry, and this Spanish magazine, Vox. And they pumped out a number of lies throughout this whole time. One, they said, against Leonardo Losa, the candidate I mentioned earlier, this journalist wrote a story about how, oh, he thinks that they should replace the picture of Jesus with Evo Morales on religious marches. It's complete fabrication. He accused the mass Senate, a mass lawmaker, of having offshore accounts in Panama because he found an account with the same surname, but there was absolutely no relation, and the candidate proved that. But that hasn't stopped him. He was hugely popular in the Bolivian media. He'd be brought on as a guest on all of the mainstream media channels. He filed a number of lawsuits, which is a very strange thing to do, to go to another country which is not your own and, you know, just file out lawsuits against each and every person that you don't like. There's a strategy, there's a coordinated strategy by fascist forces in Spain to intervene in Latin America. They hosted Juan Guaido when Juan Guaido was in Spain. So I think it's something to keep an eye on. It's something that could deepen, in fact, in a lot of countries. They'll be hoping to sort of build their links. I'm sure there was a financial relationship between the Bolivian state and the party and Vox. So I'm sure they'll be looking to get their hooks in into other countries as well.
I suppose it sums it up that it's not only the colonial Spain, yeah, but the fascists from that country.
Yeah. I should add that there's a colonial element to this. Vox is an organization that does not refer to Latin America. They call it Hispano-America, you know, as if it's part of their backyard, you know. So there's certainly a colonial approach to this. And in fact, just a couple of days ago, this journalist, Intran Basaguas, was on a Zoom sort of event amongst the far right in Spain, where he's talking about how, well, the mass only won because their supporters have zero intellectual capacity. They've never seen a phone or they've never had internet, which is not true, by the way. Internet is available throughout the country. But, you know, this was the stereotypes he had. This was how he viewed Bolivian people. And that was what he was trying to do as a journalist in Bolivia.
One thing we've certainly noticed since arriving in Bolivia is that all of the media on television is pro-coup regime, pro-coup government. Do you think that will change now that MAS is staged to come back?
Difficult, because this, as much as the right would say, oh, Evo's a dictator, or even Western media would say he's authoritarian, the fact is that throughout Evo Morales' government, the media was the same. It was the same outlets, the same media, same journalists. At least before, there was a couple of state outlets that presented the government's point of view. That doesn't exist anymore. But all of the private media has always been extremely far to the right throughout Evo Morales' government, and he never persecuted those media outlets, never jailed any journalists. And I'm sure Arce wouldn't want to either. I think the most important task for them will be supporting new independent media, building state media that puts the government's point of view across, but also alternative media outlets like the one I work for, Radio Calsachuncoca, based in the Tropico of Cochabamba, which started out as just a local media outlet for that region, local news. But once the state media outlets had disappeared, that became the only voice for at a national level that could tell people what was going on from a point of view that wasn't, you know, editorially pro-coup. So I think it would be really important to support those media projects. A number of other sort of community radio stations have popped up. And I think it'll be important to, I think in any country as well, how you can build a state media strategy, but which is works alongside a sort of alternative media realm, which isn't tied to the state financially or otherwise, or through ownership, but which can work in tandem with the state media outlets. I hope that's something that can happen. It could be a very interesting project.
Well, I know that all of us outside of Bolivia are also grateful for the work that you do and for your station. Is it possible for people in the United States and in other countries to support Causachun News?
Yeah, of course. We have a Patreon. The radio station itself is something that you can listen to on the internet. We have a number of listeners in the Bolivian community in the United States, in Argentina and other countries. And people really appreciate it because it's the only outlet. And even though we're the only outlet, you know, during this whole year, I haven't had any resources. You know, the radio used to get some money from state advertisement that disappeared. The government seized the equipment, the sort of radio transmitting equipment, in some areas of Cochabamba, in some areas of Santa Cruz, in Beni. The radio used to reach the whole of the department of Beni. Now no one can listen to it because they seized the radio transmitters. They took a number of frequencies. And, of course, there's no resources to replace that. My own colleague, Landon Marca, at the radio station, he was arrested while reporting on a union event a few months ago. He still got the charges hanging over him. He's the whole of his salary, which is everyone at the radio earns similar to a Bolivian minimum wage. All of that salary is going on his legal problems following his persecution. So that's the sort of conditions, you know, that we've all been working in. But it's, you know, wouldn't have it any other way.
Well, that's what I encourage all of our viewers to follow you and your work and support it in any way they can. Ali Vargas, it's been a pleasure. Keep up the good work.
No, it's been a pleasure having this chat. Thanks.